Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Fearscape, a paranormal podcast, part of the Fearscape Media Network. Prepare to be spooked. New episodes every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Find out more at fearscapepodcast.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Unsensitive, a show where we take a subject and talk with an expert, break it down with questions that are normally impolite to ask in company. I am your host, Ray Robinson, and today we'll be looking at challenges that adults with autism face. Joining us today in the hot seat is Becca Laurie Hector. Becca, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, wonderful. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself, Becca.
Well, I am an autism and neurodiversity consultant. I have been working in the field for about 7 years now. I started out in nonprofit, and then I kind of went out on my own to become a consultant, which is what I do now. I also coach and mentor autistic adults. In addition to that, I also happen to be an autistic adult myself. Okay. I was diagnosed at age 36. I am now 44. So that was about 8 years ago.
Excellent. Now that actually kind of leads us right into the first question that I really have. How does one go about getting diagnosed as autistic as an adult? I know it's very common with kids. Mm-hmm. People could do a lot of screening very early on just for their own educational purposes. But you know, once you're an adult, everybody kind of, you're past the educating yourself phase to a certain degree, I mm-hmm. guess. But how does one even suspect that they have autism, and then how do they go about finding out if they genuinely do?
Well, these days we're finding that our late diagnosed folk are actually finally able to find the rest of us online. When mm-hmm. I got diagnosed, not so much. There was a smaller community online, but I was raised in the 80s. So in the 80s, we used the R word like freely everywhere. Yeah. And we sent people that were the R word, we sent to separate buildings. We took them on separate buses. We didn't touch them because we got the cooties. Like that's how I was raised.
Yeah.
And so at that time when I was a child, even though I was struggling and I was already having what would now be recognized as autism struggles, nobody was looking for me because at the time when we thought about autism, you know, it was typically a white male in school age, somewhere before sixth grade, right? Non-speaking and causing behavior problems in the classroom. We weren't thinking about it interracially. We weren't talking about the women at all on the spectrum or girls on the spectrum. It just wasn't something that was really part. It wasn't what they were looking for in the profile, right? The doctors weren't looking for it. And so it wasn't until 1994 that things within the autism world and diagnosis started to change. And we went from having just kind of a classic counter autism, which is kind of the one that I described, the one that you see most in TVs and movies about autism, right? And then we started to learn about what we called then Asperger syndrome. And that was, they labeled folks with Asperger syndrome, quote unquote, more high functioning. And usually we were, speaking people, we don't have issues with speaking, for whatever the verbal about it all made it different, I guess, for people. we now are in the next phase of diagnosis, where we've moved away from even having Asperger syndrome. We now say it's autism spectrum disorder, so that all the different versions of autism all fit under the same umbrella. Right? All the different brands of it kind of tuck under there. So now it's a lot easier for a lot of reasons, historically. When I was diagnosed, we were just learning about women on the spectrum, and we were really starting to understand that there was autism in adulthood. So the truth of autism is that when you turn 18, it doesn't disappear. Well, you are still adult autistic when you wake up that morning on your 18th birthday. And it stays there for the rest of your life. So autistic adults don't disappear. We just don't receive services. So there are no supports and services available for autistic adults. Our diagnosis costs us in the thousands and isn't covered by insurance. Once we're out, any services or supports or things that we need aren't covered. So there's really not a lot we know in terms of research and study and diagnosis about adults on the spectrum. And we're learning more and more about women on the spectrum. So by the time I got to my diagnosis, things were beginning to shift to where they're kind of at now. And what's happening for autistic adults is that it's getting easier. When I was diagnosed, not as many clinicians diagnosed adults. They didn't have the expertise. Not as many clinicians had expertise in diagnosing adult females. I was lucky to be born and raised in New York City, and so I was in a metro area with a large population and a lot of clinicians. I'm lucky enough to have someone who specialized in adults and in females available to me. So many of us stumble across the diagnosis kind of accidentally. We either are dealing with what we think is some other mental health issue and our mental health clinician figures it out suddenly, or we read something somewhere that kind of clicks for us, right? Or what else? Any number of a lot for women, especially a lot of times their children are getting diagnosed and they are getting diagnosed as a result of their kids, right? They're learning about like their sons and daughters on the spectrum and going, wait, that's me, right? And going after a diagnosis. A lot of us don't get diagnosed. Some of us go through life never knowing and never getting an autism diagnosis and just struggling. Some of us can't afford a diagnosis, and because we aren't getting anything for that fancy piece of paper that says we officially have autism, there's no reason to go spend that money, right? And so we fully in the adult community respect and appreciate self-diagnosis because when you know, you know, and there's really nobody's going out running out into the world going, please let it be me that's autistic, please, right? That's not what you do, go out in the world looking for that. But when you are autistic and you find it, it feels like that. You're like, this is the thing. And it just is very exciting. And so that's sort of the state of affairs and diagnosis. I do like to share that diagnosis shouldn't happen in one session. Please, if you go and sit down to get a diagnosis with someone and they don't do any kind of testing with you and they tell you you're autistic or they tell you that you're not, either way, that is not the way a diagnosis goes down. Go see somebody else. If they tell you you're not autistic because you make eye contact as an adult, then go see someone else. We learn eye contact. If they tell you you can't be autistic because you have friends, that is a lie. If they tell you any number of the myths in that 45 minutes, also know you should see somebody else, right? And so testing should take anywhere between 6 and 8 weeks. You're going to be doing multiple forms. They're going to be asking for a history from either a family member or a spouse who's known you for a long time. Right? So there's a lot of forms happening. And then they have to read all the forms and they have to write their reports about the forms. And then they give it to you in a written format. And they also give you a report verbally. So if that's all not happening, you are not someplace where they are doing it correctly. So get yourself out and get your money back.
Which kind of does lead me to another point. Like you had said, I actually went and got tested a few years back. Not so much tested, though, from what you've described. I went to somebody that's diagnosis in children. And after talking to me for 45 minutes, he basically said, no, what you really have is just high-level social anxiety. How does one really differentiate between the two? I don't know if you are as medically aware as some to actually know how to do that.
Well, I mean, when we're looking for, we use the DSM, right? Mm-hmm. It has a checklist of itself. And what they're looking for are it's a lifetime disorder. So they're not just looking, they should not just be looking at you now. They should be taking history. They should be looking through the struggles that you were having as a child. What kinds of struggles were they? Were you having struggles as a child or did this just appear in adulthood, right? Because if it is autism, it should be there from the beginning. Yeah. And if you're a clinician that has experience in diagnosing adults, which it doesn't sound like that's where you were, right?
It doesn't sound like it now.
So different on adults that it does in children. In children, it's very, it's almost blatantly obvious in their behavior, in their body language, in their the things that they choose to do, right? Because it hasn't been co-opted out of them. Nobody's taught them that the way that they're being is wrong and that they should be different and more like everyone else yet. And so it looks different, and the tests are different for kids than they are for adults. I highly recommend, if you still think and you're still questioning, and if that's your only forte out into it, go back. Mm-hmm. I say no, and I guess social anxiety disorder is right, because that's what we all get when we're in the wrong place. Yeah. So what I want to tell you is that personally, as a human, Ray, I say, if you want to go and pursue your diagnosis, definitely do. You've had what happened to you and what's happened to many autistic adults. They've been talked out of their diagnosis by a clinician who actually is uninformed. And so what you need to do is go find somebody who knows what they're talking about. And luckily for you and everybody else out there, we have now moved to remote everything. So you can now speak with a doctor who's not necessarily in your location, who actually knows what they're talking about. So I recommend that you do those things for yourself and anybody else who's listening who's had a similar experience. If you felt like you didn't get really heard and you felt like you kind of got given the shaft there, and it was either a kid doctor who does autism diagnosis or a therapist who doesn't necessarily specialize, get yourself someone who does. We present differently. Women and men present differently in adulthood, and adults and children present differently. So there's different things that they're looking for. When we look at adults who have not been diagnosed, we see a lot of masking, which is really is what it says it is, putting on a face of normalcy, of the opposite of your natural behaviors, for other people to be comfortable, right? For their comfort. And that's what autistics who are not diagnosed get taught subconsciously to do. Don't flap your hands. Don't make that face. Don't fidget so much. Don't this, don't that, don't this. You're supposed to do this. You're supposed to say that, right? And as an adult and a human with a brain, you learn that stuff and you learn those skills really well. And then if you go sit in front of a clinician who doesn't know you've learned those skills, they're not going to see your autism. So that's what we're looking at in adulthood, is someone who has learned the coping skills to quote unquote pass, right, out in the world, and is suffering internally.
Now, kind of going back to what you had mentioned about masking, the society kind of encourages that, obviously, but kind of flipping that around, is it fair to ask the general populace to change their behaviors for the one person around them that is autistic?
Yes, because things that are beneficial to autistics, we are finding, are actually beneficial to other people. For example, some of the ways that adults struggle with autism out in the world, especially those of us that have learned to hide our autism really well, is that we go out and we do the masking, right? But we also do a lot of translating most of the time. So most of the time, 90% of the time, I'm out in the world and I'm taking neurotypical or non-autistic body language, wording, communication style, and I have to translate it into autism. And then go, okay, that's what it means. And then say, okay, how do I want, this is what I want to say back. Can't say it like that because they're not autistic. So I need to wrap it up in something pretty and maybe give them a compliment in there. And then I can say what I have to say. Autistics don't do that naturally. We are direct communicators. We say the words that we mean the words that we say. And we are not fans of lying. We are not fans of passive aggressive behavior. We are not fans of manipulative behavior. We are honest to a fault because we don't understand the purpose of putting those layers on. And oddly enough, when you ask neurotypicals why they do all of that, they too have no idea why they do all of those nonsensical things. And they also don't understand why it's so important. And they also hate doing it. Mm-hmm. And yet, the majority of the world is out there doing it. So maybe we need some autistic thinking to shake them up a little bit, because why are you doing what you don't want to be doing all the time, right? Why is that the agreed upon rule? Let's all do what we don't want to do and what doesn't make sense to us. Okay, we're all going to do that. And you who are not doing that, you are wrong, right? Well, no, right? It's a lot nicer when somebody's really direct with you about what they need or want, or right? It's nicer. Other people appreciate it. Right. And if we learn to make those things, and the things that autistics are asking for out in the world aren't huge things either. right? We're asking for maybe not so much bright fluorescent lighting in a room we're sitting in right over our heads. Could we not do that? Oh, turns out everybody thinks better when you turn off those lights, by the way. And like things like that. We're asking for our restaurants to be a little quieter so we could have a conversation at the table. Well, don't you know everybody else hates that too, right? So people are benefiting from autistics opening their mouths and asking for these odd requests, right? These strange things that we're asking for. Because what it turns out is that we're just a little bit more sensitive than the average human being to our environments, to wording, to other things. And we don't like to waste our energy and our spoons on nonsensical things like polite conversation. I really could go without seeing somebody and having to say, how are you, knowing that they're going to go fine and walk past me. And I don't really care how they are, and they don't really care how I am. And somehow this is a social requirement, right? And so I will never understand those things, and I will never do them. I will always be doing them like kind of voluntarily questioning why. Right? Why, when I come into a house party of strangers, must I hug people? Hello. I have never met you in my life. Right? What is with the assumed hug and touch? I don't know. Right? And yet, here we all are doing it. Mm-hmm. And so it's those kinds of things that autistics are asking for. What they're really asking for is an acceptance of difference. Right? Just get over it. We're all different. Right. But yeah, as a world, as a society, we've decided that sameness is the goal. We're all going to be the same, 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 whoever's not the same. Right. But nobody's the same. And so we're all fighting for an impossibility. Right? And if we just learn to accept difference and that everybody's different, we can digest difference a little bit better. It'll be a nicer world for everybody.
That makes sense. I like that. Now kind of going on to how media portrays folks that are autistic. When you mention autistic, the first thing that everybody kind of thinks of, just because it was such an award-winning movie, Rain Man.
Yep.
So minds kind of go there pretty quickly. How does the media accurately or inaccurately portray autism? Is the media ultimately helpful or hurtful for people to understand autism?
It's twofold, right? Mm-hmm. A while back, not too long ago back, like Big Bang Theory back, people were still not saying that their characters were autistic, right? They were just quirky or odd or strange or eccentric, right? We didn't talk about them as autistic. And that was always by choice, like, let's not label it. Let's not use that word. Right. And so that was where it was coming from. So we've, in a sense, stepped forward. Yes, because now we are using the word autistic about characters. Right. We openly have autistic characters in TV and all of that. But we're now in the next trap, which is stereotypes. So now we're getting just stereotyped characters of autism. Most of them are boys or men. They're mostly white. And they're those quirky, odd, nerdy looking, right? And that's our vision now. Instead of Rain Man, that's the vision of autism, right? And still not accurate, right? And we don't see female characters all that often. And when we do, they're not called autistic still, right? I think about characters like, one of my favorites that no one ever talks about is Bones. I don't know if you've ever watched the show. Yep. Bones. Mm-hmm. Okay. She is so clearly being written as an autistic character, and yet the word autism is never used. She's just intelligent and smart and, just not interested in those social things, right? So that's how recently we're talking about characters, especially female characters, not being given that label. Right, as though it's something to be ashamed of, right? And it means this specific thing. What we need to do is really look at ourselves and why are we doing that? Well, mostly because we don't understand any other experience. So that means that, the people that are writing these things don't have an experience outside of that stereotyped version of autism, and that has to change, right? I have to talk louder. Autistics have to be listened to. Autistics have to become writers of movies. Autistic actors have to be hired to play autistics, right? So that we get the accuracy that we're looking for. But nobody gets there overnight, right? We still see folks that are not disabled being put in wheelchairs to play a disabled character when there are many disabled actors out there who would love that part, right? So we are, it's not just in autism, we're seeing it across disability as a whole in the media, right? This misrepresentation of what it is to actually exist in that reality, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll get there, I think. Right now, no, you guys, you're not seeing the real thing. You know, you're seeing the stereotyped version of what it is, right? And are there people like that on the spectrum? I'm sure. We're human beings. They didn't come from nowhere, right? The stereotype. But there's so much more to us than that, right? And that's what you guys are missing out on right now. And hopefully it'll get there. Hopefully we'll be allowed into those spaces to create those authentic things.
Excellent. When folks think about, like you had mentioned, you grew up in the 80s, I did as well. And when you had when you saw somebody that was on the spectrum, they typically were in their own segregated class, and you would see maybe one of them have an episode where they would like beat on their own head or act aggressively or violently. How common is that with adults with autism? And if it is happening once in a while, what do we as neurotypicals do to make life better for a person that is going through one of those episodes?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about it. I think we are shown the physicality of those episodes, and let's give it a name, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about that kind of episode in autism, we call it a meltdown. Okay. You might have heard that word out in the world, right? And it's a really specific term in autism. It means something very specific, and you hear it a lot. People say it's not a tantrum, it's a meltdown, right? And there's a reason for that. And that reason is that tantrums and meltdowns serve different purposes. And they also come from different causes. They're caused by different things, right? So a meltdown is a tendency for autistics to literally get so overwhelmed that we go blah, like that, right? Yeah. I'm just so overwhelmed that it comes out in my body everywhere. And that can be a social confusion for us. It can be a bullying situation for us. It can be a sensory overload situation for us. It's essentially like your brain is just being pushed, and then it goes blah, right? And you can't control yourself anymore. And we've all felt that way at some point in our lives. You've either been so angry that you freaked out on somebody and said a whole bunch of crap that you didn't mean, right? And done behaviors that you would never normally do, right? And for us, that happens a little bit more often. Our brains get overloaded a little bit more easily and by different things than most people, than the neurotypical brain. The different things set us off, right? And push us to that point. And so when we see those episodes, what we weren't doing in the 80s, which we are doing now, is asking why? Why is this person having this episode? What was happening prior to it that caused the episode, right? Before, we just assumed it was, I don't know, we don't understand those folks. They just have an episode, right? That was how we looked at it. And now we're understanding that there's a why behind it, right? There's an overload happening somewhere. Are they not getting their needs met? And are they not able to express those needs? Are the people with them not able to communicate back and forth? Is that the frustration? Are they being pushed into activities or environments they're not comfortable in and they can't get out of it, right? Where is it coming from? And what can we do to change that situation so the meltdown doesn't occur? So the answer to the other part of your question is that yes, meltdowns occur in adulthood, but they look markedly different. Because as an adult, you've now learned skill sets to control your emotions, to control your body language, to control, right? And there are things you only do in the privacy of your own home and things like that, right? Every adult learns those skill sets. We learn that we shouldn't have those anger fits and say things we don't mean, especially not at work, right? We don't want to do that. That's the kind of stuff that you learn as a skill set as an adult. You just learn it, and adult autistics learn it too. And when we are finding ourselves getting closer to a meltdown, we can tell, especially if we've spent any time learning about ourselves, right? We know what's happening. We've been through it a billion times before. Sometimes, most of the time, we can exit a situation and have that meltdown alone, right? And also what it looks like is so different because you don't do the things you do as a kid when you're sad. You don't lay on the floor and clump your feet in your hands and things like that. As an adult, you've learned different skill sets. You've learned to yell or use your voice. You've learned to slam doors. You've learned to hide in the bathroom and cry it out. You've learned other skill sets for those emotions. So they look different. I would say probably 80% of my meltdowns that I have now occur in the home. They occur at home because I've held it in for such a long time over a course period of time, or because my husband knows me so well and he knows exactly how to tick me off, right? Or whatever reason they come, that's what it comes down to. I'm better at controlling it. I also know my triggers. I know my limits. I know, right? So I can control that stuff. I'm an adult now. I'm in charge of where my body ends up. People aren't dragging me all over the place, right? And so that makes it look different. Are they occurring? Absolutely. But they just look different. And probably they're not in public as much.
Gotcha. Okay. And I'm going to wind down with just one additional question that tends to come up anytime autism is talked about, especially online now, is the theory that vaccines are somehow tied to the creation of them. We all had them when we were growing up. So obviously, if you are an adult now, you probably had a vaccine from way back when. I've heard junk science on it. Yeah. I've heard people that just believe it no matter what. How accurate is that particular diagnosis of vaccines, maybe when we didn't know as much about vaccines or autism way back when? How prevalent would you say that that is? How accurate would you say that vaccines from back in the day caused autism episodes or autism diagnosis?
It has been proven entirely false, 100% false. Mm-hmm. Not even like a little bit, maybe true, like 100% false.
Okay.
And so that's the crazy thing. It's still hung around. It's still hanging around, even though it's been proven entirely false. The history behind it is actually kind of interesting. It's a little bit creepy. It's sort of like an unsolved mystery. So, but it's been solved now. So there is a gentleman who was a scientist and he was working in autism world. And what we were noticing, or what folks were noticing, is that around the time that they were getting their vaccines, their kids were starting to show the symptoms of autism. And so people started to correlate them, right? But just because they're happening at the same time doesn't mean we've proved causation. It just means that they're coming along together. And what we found out as science kind of moved along is that it's because of the development phase of 2 years old that we do the vaccine and we also see the autism, right? Mm-hmm. So we give a vaccine at 2 years old because of the stage of the body and what our immune system can handle and all of that stuff. And also at 2 years old, we start to see some of the more social aspects of autism showing up because we're starting to communicate or try to communicate, or folks are trying to communicate with us. At 6 months old, nobody's giving us a vaccine and also nobody's expecting us to have speech, right? By two, we're expecting some words, right? And so that's when we start to see, and that's why testing can begin as early as two, because that's when we can see in the developmental phase the autism or not, right? We can begin to see it at that age. And vaccines, what if they want to change when they give us vaccines, the correlation wouldn't exist, right? It's that timing. And that's where it came from. And out of this timing, this lovely scientist gentleman who was looking for a little fame and a lot of money decided he would write a paper about it and say that it was true. So he wrote a paper and he created the emergency and everybody stopped vaccinating. And now we've got this huge problem. Meanwhile, all of the scientists behind said gentleman did their research and found his stuff to be absolutely forged and incorrect. And he went ahead and killed himself. So with the man who invented the myth dead, I suggest we all let it go because it has been proven incorrect. In fact, in terms of cause of autism, we are now in somewheres about 80% believing that 80% of it is genetic. So it comes from sex. Don't let your parents have sex because they'll give you autism. That's where it comes from. And that's really the truth of it, right? It's a genetic, it's coming to us through genetics. It's coming through family lines. We see it. Those of us who are autistic can peg our autistic family members all the way back to our grandparents. And so we're seeing it. We do know that there are, of course, exceptions. There are other genetic conditions like Philip McDermott syndrome, for example, that seems to come, and that is a genetic condition, and it does have things we can do about curing symptoms and things we can, and we're looking for Philip McDermott syndrome. And it, for some reason, it likes to be attached to autism. So people with Philip McDermott tend to be autistic, right? We don't know why, we don't know. But what came out of that whole conversation was this idea that we could cure autism, right? And that has also been proven false. You just can't. It really is just the way that the brain's connections get made and the way that information is filtered through that particular brain. And that is formed in the womb. And as we are growing, those connections get made, right? And there is no one pill that's going to make that go away. What we can do is treat co-occurring conditions. So if somebody is autistic and they're struggling with sensory processing disorder, we can do things like wear sunglasses and put headphones in and stuff like that, right? If someone is suffering with depression or anxiety, we can treat the depression and the anxiety. And sometimes that relieves the discomfort in that person's life, but it didn't remove the autism. It just helps make them more functional because they were being incapacitated by the depression and the anxiety, right? Right? So we can treat those other things, but the autism itself, the foundation for all of it, isn't a broken system. It isn't something that needs to be fixed or cured. People who have autistic brains don't want a different brain. We like our brains. We're not unhappy with it. But what we would like is for the world to be a little easier for us and nicer for us, a little more accommodating. And we would like that our perspective, our different perspective gets a little bit more respect, that our reality gets validated and that our perspective gets respected, right? Because it's the out of the box thinkers in autism world that have changed the planet for the greater, that have been the inventors, the modifiers of things, the out of the box thinkers that created stuff that didn't exist before. So we need us.
All right, wonderful. Now, I'd love to, I got to say that I've actually learned a ton just from being given the different perspectives. So I'm hoping a lot of folks that are listening have as well. Tell us where we can find out more about you, your work, and anything else that we would need to do to do more research into this.
Great. So for me, if you're looking for me, I do leave myself really open. If you need resources, it's a quick email question, like what's a good book on X and X, whatever, send me an email. info@beccalaurie.com. That information is being carried around in my brain. It's there. It's easy pickings for me and I can send you a resource. Mm-hmm. Just be patient with me because I do get emails and I don't go through them all every day. So I'm a human. Give me a break. I will answer you. Do use me as a resource. The other thing you can do is head to my website, which is beccalaurie.com, L-O-R-Y.com. I put everything on there. My social media is on there. My writing is on there. My course is on there, which is now at a discount price. My newsletter's on there, which is free to sign up for. You can find my YouTube channel and come follow me there. I try to provide as many free and available resources in as many different mediums as possible for people. So come over, check out my stuff. If you dig my style, follow me. I think that's really what it comes down to. But if you think you are an autistic person out there, come find us. We're out here, all you have to do is hop on Facebook. It's where we built our community. Hop on Facebook, Google autism. You will have a bazillion groups to choose from. You will find groups for somebody just like you. And so find them. Know you're not alone anymore. And go after what you need. Because you can live the life you want to live that's in the back of your head that you're not living, letting yourself do right now. So it's out there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your expertise, giving us a little of your own backstory and getting personal with us and dealing with the hot seat of these obnoxious questions I ask.
Happy to help educate. I really appreciate even your style, just the approach, because when I do my job, I always tell people, this is your chance. Ask the embarrassing questions. Mm-hmm. I am not someone who is easily embarrassed. And I talk about this stuff all the time and it's my job to share the information. So, ask us. We want to talk about us. We want to share with you.
Wonderful. So, and speaking to the listeners, if you have a subject that you're knowledgeable on, you're passionate about, please reach out to me. I'd love to give you a forum like I have with Becca here and to kind of explain where you're coming from and what everything is about. I'd love to have you here on Unsensitive and to tell us a little bit more about this subject that you are passionate about and to field all those uncomfortable questions that you normally wouldn't get at a party to explain to folks. So reach out to me, rayrobwrites@gmail.com. You can also find out more about Unsensitive on any of your podcast broadcasters and the Fearscape Media Network, which I'm a part of. You can just look us up and direct towards us. So thank you once again for listening to Unsensitive, and thank you so much for keeping an open mind on all subjects.